Welcome to the Something to Gnaw On podcast, usually a short parable-style devotional for the Christian with a short attention span, and I'm your host, Nate Vineo. We're starting what I would call a sub-series, calling it the Scenic Route through the Book of Isaiah, where I want to take a bit more time to work through the book than I had spent in the Crash Course through the Old Testament series, yet taking some lessons we learned in the process and applying them to this book. And in the process, I hope to make the Old Testament and the books of the prophets a little less intimidating. Really, I hope it comes alive to you, and hopefully it sparks an interest for listeners to get into the Bible for themselves. Remember the cliche saying, get into the Word, and let the Word get into you. This is episode 2 in the series, King Ahaz and the High Places. How bad does a nation have to get to incur the wrath of God? It's a legit question, given that there are those who think of God as a tyrant in the sky, bent on taking a life for every little misstep. Surely mankind should know where the point of no return is. But let's keep in mind, this kind of an assertion of God being a divine tyrant is usually based more on breakroom rhetoric and atheistic banter as opposed to historical fact. A theme that has come to the surface in our scenic drive through the book of Isaiah so far is that God's holiness and all that comes with it, along with God's love and all that comes with it, are a choreographed 1-2 punch in the book of Isaiah. Sometimes you have to look at the text a bit more intently, but other times it's absolutely blatant. I need to issue a warning at the first part of this episode. I do not mark my episodes as explicit, as I keep the language proper and there's no use of foul language. However, I think it's fair and respectful to warn you that if you have a weak stomach or highly bothered with depictions of pagan worship, you might want to fast forward at least a minute or two. I want to be respectful of people's sensitivities while at the same time calling out some of the explicitly disgusting elements of pagan worship in the era for what it was, and we'll be looking at how potentially they may be similar to what we have going in our culture today. So let's get back to the original question here. How bad does a nation have to get to incur the wrath of God? Or what about the church for that matter? How bad does a church have to get, or a community, or a person, or a region? What if they were sacrificing children, or aborting them, or taking innocent life from those so young they have to play the music so loud to drown out the screams of the child to keep the parents from changing their mind? Or what if they have to tie a live child to the altar so it doesn't writhe its way off of the altar as it burns in the flame? Is God justified then? Is he waiting to pounce then? What if the governmental leadership systematically eliminates the religious expression of a people group? What about that of the church? What if the government nails the doors shut, sells off the sacred elements of the church, and repurposes what is declared holy by God as something that is distinctly declared as an abomination by him? Is God justified then? Is he waiting to pounce? What if the powers that be take one of the most sacred parts of the church, the worship service, and twist every tradition, every divine command, every sanctified step in the process of corporate worship in an effort to be edgy and ahead of the curve or relevant? What if this meant church leaders traded in their smoke machines for, wait for it, cannabis machines? That is to say, marijuana smoke dispensaries. And I am being serious here. What if worship involved a free hit off the pipe, a free joint for communion, or instead of a coffee bar, the church just had a place for you to get your marijuana paraphernalia before walking into service? And what if they had a bring the bong to the temple event? Would God be justified then? Would he be waiting to pounce? And for those of you that think that I'm being a bit over the top here, check the show notes for the references for the story from the Armstrong Institute for Biblical Archaeology and Hebrew University. Additionally, it's also noted by the Smithsonian regarding the finding of cannabis on a secondary altar of incense in a hidden pagan temple in a little town just a little bit south of Jerusalem. It was found in an archaeological dig about 4 years ago, and given the combination of advances in scientific identification and the amount of residue that remained, both altars were tested for their contents, confirming that both biblical incense and cannabis, along with animal excrement, were present. And when those archaeologists found these sites 4 years ago, what era do you think it points to? If you guessed the reign of King Uzziah, you'd be getting close. Isaiah said in chapter 1 that he served under Kings Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. We covered Uzziah last week. We may mention Jotham somewhere along the lines, and we'll eventually get to Hezekiah. But this week, we're going to be talking about King Uzziah's grandson, King Ahaz, the king whose reign is connected to the great cannabis find from 4 years ago, and one who's considered to be one of the most wicked kings in Judah. Let me give you the quick and abbreviated rundown of what happened and why, biblically speaking, of course, it's a problem. If you go back and read through the Pentateuch, especially Exodus and Leviticus, you'll find that God had specific instructions for worship, and these rules were not to be deviated from. There were instructions on what kind of an animal to bring for whatever sacrifice, and how it was to be prepared, and under what circumstances to bring it, what to do with the blood and the waste and the meat, which altar to put it on, what to burn it with, etc., etc. Lots and lots of details. And this all had to do with the sin offerings. And I'm grateful that under the new covenant, Jesus took care of that once and for all, and that we aren't subject to the Old Testament system. But this doesn't mean that there isn't anything for us to learn here. In fact, quite the opposite is true. So hang with me here. In Jewish temple worship, there's an altar called the Altar of Incense, and it's one incredibly important altar to God. God gets very specific about not only the recipe for the incense, but for the type of fire that will burn the incense. He's specific about its location, about how it's made, about which way it faces. And according to the text, it was supposed to be placed directly in front of the veil, in front of the Ark of the Covenant. He's specific about who is supposed to offer the incense, which is Aaron and his direct descendants. He's specific about when it was supposed to be burnt, and that is every morning and every evening. And whatever the ultimate purpose, God's final instruction to Moses on this is, quote, "You shall not offer unauthorized incense or burnt offering or grain offering, and you shall not pour drink offering on it." And he caps off the verse with this phrase, "It is most holy to the Lord." And you'll find all that in Exodus 30, verses 1 through 11. And again, it's not just holy, but it is most holy. Now, without getting into the details of both, let me just say that in Leviticus 10, you'll read a story about two knucklehead PKs who thought they could get away with doing it differently. Here's what the text says about them. Quote, "Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord, and it consumed them, and they died before the Lord." End quote. This is how important the altar of incense is to God. And is this not what King Uzziah taught us in the last episode? God is not messing around with the severity and the importance of the altar of incense. Uzziah got off easy with 10 years of leprosy, plus or minus, and isolation, of course, and had plenty of time to change his heart, so he got off a whole lot easier than Nadab and Abihu. But still, the issue remains that this is something that God is incredibly serious about. So when archaeologists find this pseudo-temple south of Jerusalem, what they found was one of these places that are referred to as the high places, which is quite a humorous term now given the finding recently. For years they've literally been referring to these places as the high places, and nobody realized that they were actually burning weed there. So how fitting is that? Anyhow, talk about prophetic. Anyhow, That being said, does anybody remember the old Ron Canole worship song from the 1990s, the old hype up the crowd song of going up to the high places, going to tear the devil's kingdom down? Anyhow, I was thinking about that this week, and it just humors me at the moment. So anyhow, all righty, moving on. The way this newly discovered high place was laid out was similar in format to the temple, except to say that next to the altar of incense, they had a secondary altar, an altar of cannabis. I'm not sure that's what they called it, but that's what it is in practicality. And in addition to the unauthorized burning of marijuana, to get the full effect, they had to burn it with animal dung. Apparently, when God set up the recipe for the proper incense, he also set up the proper type of wood or coal to burn at a temperature that brought out the most effective aromatic scent from the frankincense. The problem for those who wanted to smoke their weed in these high places was that the same coals that burned the frankincense would not get the desired effect out of the cannabis. So to get the desired effect out of the cannabis, they would have to burn animal dung, which burned at a significantly different temperature. What an absolute mess this is shaping up to be. It's what I would call a three-step mess. Let's look at it. Messy step number one. They had pretend worship happening where it shouldn't, outside the temple, outside of God's design. That is to say that worship in the temple was eventually shut down as well, and you can read about that in 2 Chronicles 28 and 2 Kings 16. But these high places, at least the one found by archaeologists 4 years ago, were laid out in similar fashion as the temple in Jerusalem. But despite any similarity, it was 100% wrong and against God's prescribed plan. And at the same time, there was a systematic dismantling of the temple in Jerusalem and its services. And again, you can read about that in the 2 Kings 16 and 2 Chronicles 28 accounts. So step one is simply having a form of religion, but it grossly violated every rule of the Old Testament. This type of religious rebellion is nothing new. It isn't the first time, and it surely won't be the last. There's an interesting verse in the New Testament, in 2 Timothy 3. Let me just read it here to you. It's kind of long, but you'll get the picture. From Paul to Timothy, quote, "In the last day there will be very difficult times, for people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing God," there's one, "disobedient to the parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred," there's another. "They will be unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and love pleasure rather than God," and there's another. "They will act religious," and another. "And they will reject the power that could make them godly," there it is. And the key instruction from Paul to Timothy here at the end, stay away from people like that. There's nothing new under the sun. This isn't Paul's first go-around with this. He knew Jewish history, and history is cyclical and repetitive. So messy step number one is simply having a form of religion, a dangerous form of religion, and denying its power, notwithstanding many of the other characteristics that Paul mentioned a moment ago. Okay, moving on to messy step number two. They had a type of prayer and worship or incense being burnt that is more about the effect that it has on the participant than about how pleasing it is to the Lord. Everyone needs to stop and chew on this one for a minute. Press pause if you have to, come back later. But give this due thought here. When a culture, and especially a religious culture, when they get to a place where the importance of the personal experience of the worshiper or the church attendee, when that exceeds what the deity deserves and receives, then you've drifted into a dangerous realm of idolatry. Make no mistake about it, doing worship and church by the book, you will get plenty out of your time with the Lord, and you should. But whatever you and I get should be a byproduct of what God receives and what He gives back, not the sole focus of the corporate worship event. As we move through the book of Isaiah, this issue of idolatry in a myriad of forms will be prevalent. And on several occasions, God says He will not share His glory with another. And as we saw how God handles Nadab and Abihu and Uzziah, God is serious about this. It needs to be understood that this is a serious offense to offer strange incense, strange worship, strange prayers. And I need to add here that all the elements of temple worship, as designed by God, prove to be a type and shadow for us under the new covenant. So for clarity's sake, think of the whole process of the temple as worship. The key component is the altar where the sacrifice is made, and Christ is that sacrifice. The Holy of Holies, or the most holy place, used to be a place that only one priest could enter, and only once per year. Now the Holy of Holies dwells inside of us. More important to today's podcast, when it comes to the altar of incense, it's clearly a symbol of prayer. Psalm 141:2, David says, "Accept my prayer as incense offered to you, and my upraised hands as an evening offering." If you skip to the end of the book, you go to Revelation 5:8, and it says, "When he took the scroll," this is a picture of what's going on in heaven that John sees, "and when he took the scroll, the four living beings and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb," that's Jesus. "Each one had a harp, and they held a gold bowl filled with incense, which are the prayers of God's people." And again, this is echoed again in Revelation 8, 3, and 4. And let's not forget Isaiah's words in chapter 56, verses 7 and 8, where he says, where God is speaking through Isaiah, of course, where it says, "I will bring them to my holy mountain of Jerusalem, and I will fill them with joy in my house of prayer. I will accept their burnt offerings and sacrifices, because my temple will be called a house of prayer for all nations." And what's beautiful with this is that three of the gospel writers quote Jesus as saying this as he's cleansing the temple. The altar of incense is no secondary or tertiary element of worship. It's absolutely essential, day and night. It was offered in front of the veil, before the most holy place, before the altar of the presence. Offering the incense put the priest as close to the presence of the Lord on a daily basis as anyone could get at the time. And if this isn't driving the point home enough, listen to what Dr. R.C. Sproul of Ligonier Ministries stated about it back in 2010. Quote, "The ascending smoke symbolizes that what was offered there went up to God, much as our prayers go up before Him. Being set outside the veil, the priest would see the smoke penetrate the curtain into the Holy of Holies, even though he couldn't see past the curtain." And is this not like prayer, in that we know our prayers enter heaven itself, even though we cannot see into it yet? The altar of incense reminded Israel to pray and assured the people that their prayers were sweet-smelling to the Lord. If you want to read more on that, I'll have the link in the show notes as well. Step 3, they're flat-out delusional. To accomplish steps number 1 and 2, they had to completely defile themselves by burning animal excrement in a setting that is supposedly holy, but obviously is not. Their idea of what was holy and what is worship is totally contrary to the law. In the archaeological dig, they set up the holy right next to the profane, and somehow have an expectation that God would be okay with it. How delusional do you have to be? Do they not remember that Nadab and Abihu died because of such irreverence? Do they not remember Uzziah's leprosy from his rebellion just a few years previous? That being said, if there was a new church growth method that came across the internet that involved giving out free weed instead of literature or cookies or coffee or donuts, I'm sure there'd be plenty of delusional people lining up for their personal experience, and that's Of course, just my armchair opinion on the matter. But I'm going to move on to some other details in a moment, but I want to issue a serious challenge here. Look at your prayer life. Look at the worship in your church and the prayer in your church. Is it about what people get out of it? Is it about the experience? Now be careful here, because giving God His just worship and us getting something out of it are not mutually exclusive issues, but what needs to happen is what God gets needs to be the primary focus. Is the focus to come together to give God the glory and the honor He rightly deserves? And in our personal prayer lives, have you noticed how the Lord's Prayer begins with honoring Him and praising Him and asking Him for His kingdom to come and His will to be done before we ask anything about ourselves? The message today is not that we don't get anything. It's not that we're having to give up anything. It's that we worship Him first. It's not about us. It's not about new. It's not about edgy. It's not about relevant. It's not about our feelings. First and foremost, it's about God and how He longs for things to be. Honor that, and you'd be amazed at what He gives back. It's an amazing part of God's character. The law of first fruits, some people call it. I don't have time to get into it right now, but when you give God the first, and I would add probably here that you give it in the manner in which that He prescribes, but when you give God first, He has a way of multiplying it back to you. And it isn't just a monetary thing. Some people use that in terms of kind of a prosperity gospel, and that's not the case necessarily. Remember Hannah? A woman who was weeping bitterly in the temple, and Eli comes into the temple and chastens her for crying and calling her a drunk. And she says, no, she was praying. She was grieved to her heart and asking the Lord for a son. And in doing so, when God gave her a son, she gave him back. And the woman who was barren ended up having several more children. The law of first fruits, not related to money. Anyhow, moving on. Worship God first and give Him what He requires, and let Him respond however He wishes. I have a hard time believing that anybody would be disappointed under those circumstances. Okay, so let's get back to the history and the archaeology of this episode. I began with asking a basic question of how bad does a nation have to get to incur the wrath of God? All the aforementioned situations relating to child sacrifice and shutting down the temple and worshiping in the high places all come to a crossroad in the person and the reign of King Ahaz. Frankly, it could be our culture too. Child sacrifice or abortion, shutting down churches or silencing them or attempting to silence the voice of the church on matters in which they can speak or not speak. Then you have the church degenerating from within, almost imploding, becoming more emblematic of the culture that it was sent to save. And as we dig into this book of Isaiah, I'm reminded of the comment that the late David Wilkerson made regarding the application of the prophetic books to our current situations in life. If you don't know who Wilkerson is, he's most famously known as the founder of Teen Challenge, the Times Square Church in New York City, as well as several other ministries. And keep in mind that Teen Challenge is a highly successful addiction recovery ministry that began on the streets of New York City and has run the world over with its scripture-based approach to overcoming strongholds and breaking addictions. And dare I call them idols too. So when I pass this quote along, this is not just some random Facebook post or social media meme. This is coming from a man who has ministered to thousands and seen them delivered and set free from the very things that are happening in the days of Ahaz. Tim DeLena, the current pastor at Times Square Church, had the opportunity to talk with him and had noticed that he was using the books of prophecy to preach on the social ills of his time. And this was David Wilkerson's response. Behavior is cyclical, so sin is predictable. So in essence, he's saying that if we can see a behavior happening, the sin to follow is reasonably predictable. And the same way it offended God in the past will be the same way it offends Him now. And dare I say, and dare I add, that if sin is predictable, then it's also preventable. So when we read through the prophets, the primary understanding is to figure out who the prophet is speaking to, what the circumstances of the time are, and what specifically is being communicated. Then it's no quantum leap at that point to draw similarities when the same circumstances line up, the same attitudes line up, the same power struggles, and the same demonic strategies line up to our current situations. And it's not inappropriate to apply the truth of how God approves or disapproved of that in the past. I've kind of folded my hand here, but I think that there's a mountain of evidence that is similar to our culture right now that is either spot-on accurate or within striking distance given time. So as we read further through this interaction between Isaiah and Ahaz in our next few episodes, keep an eye out for these similarities and how they may apply in our personal situations. In the weeks to come, we'll be looking at Isaiah 7, which is another epic clash between a king and a prophet. And God calls it a take-your-son-to-work day and has Isaiah take his son for a front-row seat to this confrontation. And before we get there next week, I would encourage you all to take the time to read up on the first part of Isaiah 7, which is the encounter that we're going to be looking at. And additionally, feel free to read 2 Kings 16 and 2 Chronicles 28. Both of these passages provide key details about Ahaz and his disposition. Oftentimes, people say ignorant things about God judging people or people groups. And in this situation, there's a judgment coming, no doubt. But what is mind-bending is how God handles this entire process. You've heard me say often that when you get into the Word and the Word gets into you, that when you hear sermons or podcasts in this case, you move from hearing revelation to hearing confirmation, meaning that when you read this text for the first time, God will show you things which would be revealing, and then He will confirm things in the sermon or the podcast like this. If you read this text, I promise you, you will get more out of it. So dig into it this week, and let's go over it again next week. Isaiah 7, 2 Kings 16, 2 Chronicles 28. Go over those. That's your homework assignment. This week's episode is just setting the cultural background and backdrop for next week's study. And as we close, I'm reminded of a song that we used to sing at church back in the 90s. And I will say that I was a bit humored by the song after this episode and thought that I might share it with you as fitting as it was. So until next week, God bless. And let me know what you think of the song.